This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
All right, and tonight on Where Did the Road Go? I was initially going to have Peter Robbins on, but we're going to have to reschedule Peter Robbins for a few weeks from now, either in November or December. He isn't feeling too well tonight. But to the rescue, I have a Joshua Kutchin.
To the rescue.
And for the first time, Red Pill Junkie.
So the Mexicans are your second option? Is that what you're saying, Soraya?
No, I'm saying people already know who Joshua is.
No, I think a lot more people know who Red Pill Junkie is than Josh. So,
well, people who only listen to the show will know who Joshua is, because you've been on quite a few times. You've been doing the midweek podcasts.
Fair enough.
And we have been talking about bringing Red Pill Junkie here onto the show. And we finally made that happen. And I plan to have you on some midweek podcasts in the future. This was initially going to be a midweek podcast until Peter had a dropout. So,
well, whatever the case, you know, it's a pleasure being here and speaking with you and with Joshua.
And you are from Mexico.
That is right, señor.
And you always wear a mask.
Whenever I'm in public, yeah. It's kind of awkward and a bit, you know, messy.
Are you a big wrestling fan, or are you just anonymous?
Just anonymous. You know, I've been only once to the Arena Mexico here in Mexico City, and that's because, you know, a female friend invited me. You know, anyway, you know, messy story. Let's move on.
you want to tell people about the name Red Pill Junkie real quick?
Okay, the name, it's kind of a strange happening. Why I chose the name, maybe the name chose me, you know, who knows. The idea kind of emerged from the fact that when I was finishing college, I became really, really interested in the works of Carlos Castañeda, who is not really that well known today, but back in the day, in the 1960s, he was really one of the most important figures in the counterculture movement, right, you know, right? Oh, yeah. Along with Timothy Leary and all those guys, you know. He released the book, The Teachings of Don Juan, and it became, you know, almost an overnight bestseller. You know, he appeared in the cover of Time magazine. Well, appear figuratively speaking, because, you know, the guy had this rule of never showing his face in public. You know, maybe one of the reasons why I also try to be more or less anonymous. But anyway, when I then watched the movie The Matrix, you know, back in 1999, mm-hmm. I really became hooked with the story and with the universe that the Wachowski siblings created, and I immediately thought that they were heavily influenced as well with Castañeda, you know. So I saw it as the perfect metaphor of Castañeda's philosophy. So Neo, you know, portrayed by Keanu Reeves, was Carlos, no, the young newcomer who is like taken under the wing of Morpheus or Don Juan in Carlos Castañeda's story. This, you know, wizard or mentor who teaches his young student about the true nature of the universe and how, you know, the reality that we live on is just an illusion. And the way that he shows him that is, you know, in the case of the Matrix, by making Neo take the red pill. And in the case of Carlos Castañeda was, you know, by using what in the books are called power plants, you know, entheogenic substances, you know, peyote and other types of hallucinogenic psychedelic substances. And in the basic idea of this was to try to stop the way in which we perceive the world and to see the universe as, in the case of Carlos Castañeda, to see the universe as as lines of energy, and the human body as a glowing egg. And if you recall, by the end of the Matrix movie, when, you know, Neo is like, you know, resuscitated or whatever, he sees, you know, the agents, Agent Smith and his other minions, you know, as figures of energy, and, you know, she sees the rest of the Matrix, you know, as lines of code falling down. And that's why I really see, you know, there was this kind of strange correlation, and that's why, you know, by some strange happening or coincidence, when I started to become very active in the online forums, I chose the moniker Red Pill Junkie.
All right. And it's a great moniker as well.
Thank you. One of the reasons that I like the moniker is that it reminds me never to take myself too seriously. And I think that's one of the most wisest approach whenever if you are decided to delve into this wacky world of the 4chan, you know, mysteries.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
There's a great quote that's a favorite of mine from Alan Rickman, the great great character actor, and he says, I take my work very seriously and myself not at all. So
that's a great quote.
Yeah.
Yes, that's perfect. I should mention I'm absolutely horrible about plugging things, but I do have a patron account or a Patreon account, as they have an extra E in there. And it's basically going to serve as a membership for Where Did the Road Go? And for $3 a month, you will get extra stuff, discounts on merchandise when I actually have enough patrons to make merchandise, and have some other special stuff planned as more people sign up for it. So check that out. It's on the website at wheredidtheroadgo.com, and I tried to keep it as cheap as possible, and you'll be getting a lot of stuff back for supporting us. And if you like the show as well, we are hoping to be able to do more shows in the future rather than just one a week as time goes on. Now, for tonight, let's look at, to start off, this alien megastructure that's all over the news.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, they, you know, I mean, everyone is treating this like we've found, as I just said, an alien megastructure, like extraterrestrials have built something. But in reality, we're just seeing something that astronomers can't explain.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, it reminds me of what happened when astronomers first found what they initially interpreted as a possible extraterrestrial beacon. You know, something, you know, an astronomical signal that was, you know, sending a very energetic pulse of radiation, you know, at a very rapid pace, you know. And I think that some astronomers were really considering the possibility that this was some type of beacon of maybe the equivalent of what we will call here in Earth, you know, the kind of lights that will guide, you know, navigators and sailors, you know, at away of the cliffs, a lighthouse, right? So kind
right.
of like a lighthouse in the cosmos to maybe, you know, guide spaceships, you know, through their journey to among the stars. But then, you know, at the end, astronomers decided that no, that these were more than likely a natural natural form of radiation, and they call them pulsars. You know, that is the how we interpret it today, and maybe that is what will happen with this recent discovery of what it seems to be some kind of anomaly between a very old star and a very strange looking form of a cloud that is surrounding the stars, obscuring its light, and that shouldn't be there, because that is the kind of thing that we should expect with younger stars, you know, the stars that are still forming, you know, and maybe the planets are starting to coalesce among the particles of dust. So that is the things that are making astronomers scratching their heads, you know. So for people to say, oh my God, you know, aliens, you know, artificial origin, that is still possible, but you know, you have to keep it in perspective. You know, we just don't know. We are just guessing by really small amounts, the small amount of information that our technological instruments are relaying to us.
Now, this is where I jump in and I derail the conversation with careless speculation. I feel like this is one of the more encouraging findings that we've had in a long time, simply because a lot of the scientific establishment is sort of entertaining the idea that it could be anomalous. So extrapolating that, the question that was immediately on my mind was, let's walk this through its logical paces. Let's say that somehow those observing it are able to determine that these are indeed alien megastructures, extraterrestrial in origin. Where does that put those of us who really are interested in the high strange elements of UFO cases when it comes to how we address this phenomena going forward? So what I'm saying is that basically every man, woman, child on the street would say, well, of course aliens are real. They have the megastructures. So therefore, every UFO sighting is an alien coming down in a nuts and bolts craft. When those of us who are more plugged into the synchronicities, to the reality warping aspects of the phenomena, might say, well, that doesn't quite answer the larger questions that are posed by the phenomena and have been posed for centuries. Where does that put us? Does it marginalize further those who are interested in the high strange aspects, those who think that the UFO phenomena is somehow tied into consciousness and reality? Where does that leave us in that entire scenario?
That's a fantastic question. And I mean, my gut feeling is that we're looking at something that we simply, that's natural, that we don't understand.
Oh, and I would agree with that.
You know, everyone's all excited about it, but we're also interpreting that aliens would build things like we would build
exactly.
Things.
Exactly.
Yep. On the nose.
I think if we find alien life, we're not going to necessarily recognize it right away.
Mm-hmm.
Other planets in the solar system could have alien life, but we're looking for life that's like us.
Right.
You know, you could have intelligent life deep in the gases of Jupiter.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I was on Radio Mysterioso with Greg Bishop a few months back, and there was a very pointed question about conversation that we had about I believe it was in a Michael Crichton novel. If not, it was some sort of essay that I read, where a bunch of folks at NASA got together and they were positing what alien life would look at, and the first question was, well, where's the anus? And of course, that's a ridiculous question, because you know, you're assuming that a biological entity would have the same sort of digestive tract that we would. So it's that right. Exact same thing. It could be so alien that we can't even acknowledge it. What I'm interested in is, what happens when everyone around us thinks they have the answer? What happens to those of us who realize that that can't be the complete answer?
Oh, sure. Sure. It's going to separate things out further, I think, than they already are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and at the same time, you know, this idea of thinking of an alien intelligence as something so separate from us that we wouldn't even be able to recognize it also is counter to the notions back in the 1950s or even back in nowadays with the modern take on ufology. You know, I mean, if you go and talk to people in MUFON, they are still seeing things, you know, they are still interpreting the UFO phenomenon as some people who are just a few hundred years ahead of us, but who will conduct themselves pretty much the same as we do. You know, they will have their astronauts, you know, they will have, you know, their space agency sending, you know, explorers out into the cosmos, you know. And, mm-hmm. And that is, you know, the thing that the, even the contactees were saying, you know, George Adamski and all that, you know. You, well, you know, you have this Venusian guy who just looks just like me, you know. He just happens to be, come from another planet, you know. Or even, you know, Billy Meyer, you know, with Sam Jassy, you know, this hot-looking, you know, Pleiadian babe, you know, who is, was a humanoid like him, but, you know, she... instead of commuting, you know, with a car, you know, she you will commute to her work, you know, with a spaceship. But it's still this idea of trying to interpret what we don't comprehend in trying to put it into more manageable terms. And it's obvious. It's a very human reaction. You know, it's very difficult to get away from that. I think that few, even in the arts, few people have tried to depart from that. I think that a perfect example with, for that will be H.P. Lovecraft, you know, trying to conceive things and entities and intelligence that will be so devoid from the human perspective that will be almost impossible to describe.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And he was so ahead of his time that no one got what he was doing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I you had said something before we started this, Josh, that the sightings, the lights in the sky are interesting you less and less when it comes to this phenomena.
Oh. And no, go ahead. Sorry.
And I've kind of felt that way for a while where, you know, I mean, they're interesting, certainly. And I've seen a few UFOs myself, and they're always it's always interesting, but it's the interactions that people have that tend to be of a little more interest to me.
Well, you know, I'm reminded of something that a quote that Mike Cleland is fond of bringing up about John Mack once saying, "Haven't we moved on from lights in the sky?" I think that it's still very important to examine these things, and I think it's still very important to acknowledge and record such sightings, but you know, I think what matters to all of us in studying space and in studying lights in the sky is the intelligence behind it. You know, is in what that says about not only whether or not we're alone in the universe in this reality, spiritually, but also just in terms of, you know, what it says about us ourselves. And I think that seeing an anomalous light in the sky doesn't give that layer of depth to the experience that is what really interests me. You know, when you have an interaction with an other, that's what really grabs my attention. And so basically what I'm getting at is I think that there is an important place for lights in the sky and an important thing for anomalous objects. But when you get where when you get to the point where photographic evidence is never going to prove anything, and video evidence is never going to prove anything, and eyewitness evidence is sure as heck not going to prove anything, then you have to sort of throw up in your hands and say, well, let's maybe we should maybe give a little bit more focus and attention to either interactions with some sort of other intelligence, or what I would really propose is focusing on what that light in the sky did to the observer. Mm-hmm. You know, what that light in the sky did to the person who saw it. Something that I'm fond of saying is that I feel like sometimes the UFO phenomena is the master pointing at the bone and we're staring at the hand as a dog. You know?
Yeah, are either of you familiar with the work Andrew Collins did? I think it was Light
yes.
Quest. Mm-hmm. And I thought his idea of these things, of these lights being plasma oriented was very interesting. Not the first time anyone, you know, had projected that idea, but, you know, he mixes in there the interactions with consciousness with what are essentially plasma consciousness. And I don't know, I always go back to that. Like that always, there's something about that that really kind of sticks with me when you see these different sightings and these different encounters.
And interestingly enough, I think the first person who first suggested the idea that UFOs might be, you know, plasma formations was actually at the bunker, Philip Glass,
yeah,
you know?
Yes, it was.
Talk about irony there.
But he wasn't suggesting they were intelligent in any way, no. Whereas these things definitely behave intelligently and can look like, you know, plasma apparently can take the shape of metallic sort of objects.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, and it's sort of, you know, it resonates a lot with a lot of Arabic jinn lore, which talks about, you know, smokeless flame. And a lot of people have equated that with plasmas as well, and also with some of the ideas of Ivan Sanderson, who posited possible intelligences, possible entities, the UFO itself as an entity in the night sky. You know, and I think honestly, like, I'd be fine with that, and that isn't any less interesting to me than some sort of spiritual experience or some sort of extraterrestrial experience. It really isn't. Nor would an heretofore unexplained atmospheric phenomena be any less interesting to me than those. Well, maybe a little bit, but
it wouldn't explain the interactions people have.
No, which is again why I keep on coming back to the actual interactions with intelligences, because it implies something deeper to that interaction.
I mean, I know I've mentioned it with I believe I mentioned it with you, Joshua, where I wonder if the lights in the sky are actually sometimes a side effect of something going on, say, with the Earth, that's also altering our consciousness, and we're connecting it to that light in the sky, whereas the encounter we're having with other intelligences have nothing to do with the light. The light is just another side effect of that energy being put out by the Earth that's shifting our consciousness.
Right. The locomotive pulling into the station releases steam, but steam isn't the main event.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah.
Also, let me point out something, you know, when we were talking about, you know, the idea that some UFOs appear to be structural metallic craft, we really don't know if that is the case. You know, we assume it is because the objects appear to have the characteristic of metal. You know, I mean, let me explain this. You know, I'm an industrial designer by trade, and one of the things that I used to do in my former job was to do a lot of computer renderings. You know, a lot of photorealistic renderings using computer generating you know, image software like 3D Studio Max and whatever. So in those softwares, in those programs, you learn how to fake materials like wood, like glass, like metal, like stone, based on their reflective and refractive properties, the way in which behave in how light bounce off of them, and that is how you manage to create a convincing looking metal, even though it's just a simulation, you know? So what I'm getting at is, okay, so that there are a few UFO accounts in our catalogs and on our records that appear to show a metallic-looking craft, but that doesn't mean that it's a metal.
No, you know, I have to give you a slow clap for that one, RPJ, because I hadn't really thought about that. And again, what I would sort of tee up from that, to borrow an Alex Sakaris phrase, would be, why do you as a designer emulate other materials? Why do you do that?
Oh, because that is the way in which, you know, you create something that is still not there. You know, in other words, let's put an example. I'm designing a table, right? I'm going to create a table for a client, but before I go and do the thing with the carpenter, I first have to show the design to the client to see if it's all right. So I create a convincing simulation that it's in all regards inside this artificial environment, almost indistinguishable from, you know, an actual photograph of a real object. But that is something that is only exists, you know, as, you know, ones and zeros, you know, as a digital construct inside a computer software.
Right, and the finished product too. I mean, it elicits a reaction from someone seeing simulated wood that they wouldn't have when viewing, you know, the actual polymer or whatever it is. You know, it elicits a reaction within them, you know, of oh, this is nice, this is a luxury item, or something along those lines.
Exactly. You started to interpret reality in very different terms. You know, what looks like, you know, a certain thing, like a certain material or a certain object, may not be what it actually appears to.
Right.
Well, that's why I was saying, you know, plasma can give off the appearance of being metallic when it's actually plasma. Mm-hmm. And since you do have enough cases where people think they've seen some kind of metallic object, and I think Andrew postulated that we enter some kind of bubble universe as they come closer. But I would think a consciousness alteration of some sort would also do just as well to explain that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I do too. It's been a minute since I've read Andrew's work, but you know, it ties into these bigger themes that we always come back to, I feel like, which is, you know, how much of the observed is objective, and how much of the observer is playing a role in what is observed.
Yeah, yeah, and of course the problem is you do have physical traces.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the things that I really liked about you recommended to me Patrick Harper's Demonic Reality, yes, which anybody who can get their hands on a copy should read, because it's so fundamentally, it's the internal consistency of logic in that book is just so striking. But he addresses that, and he sort of comes to the conclusion in some ways that that it's almost, they almost exist to confound these trace elements, because mm-hmm. it's always inconclusive. And it's always, you know, it's always just fantastic enough and just concrete enough to make the skeptic second guess, and just mundane enough to make the people who were there second guess themselves.
I haven't read that book, but correct me if I'm wrong, Joshua. Is he suggesting that these experience, these manifestations, or these entities come from a lower realm than us, and then, you know, a few occasions, you know, interact with us and leave a few things that, you know, just will make us, you know, confound us and think that they come from, you know, from our reality?
Even having read it relatively recently, I believe in like the last 4 months,
it's hard to put in a nutshell.
Yeah, in some ways, I feel ill prepared to speak with authority on it.
It's more that he postulates there's another realm of existence, not necessarily higher or lower, but more subjective.
Okay.
That he calls the imaginal realm, that he takes from the Greek terminology.
Yeah.
And that this realm will interact with us at certain points.
Well,
and this creates most of the everything from Bigfoot sightings to UFO sightings, etc., that because they're all daemonic, not demonic, but daemonic, coming from this daemonic imaginal realm that's very subjective and can shift and morph depending on who's witnessing
it. And it's all sort of wrapped up in this hermeneutic bow, wherein certain things are representative of the hermetic or Apollonic self. So in other words, the feminine fluid self, or the masculine fixed self as well. So it's not light reading, but
no.
it's one of those books that you read and it really does sort of change your perspective on these things.
Well, what I would suggest then is, you know, the conclusions that I personally have come to is that that other realm, imaginal realm, is actually, you know, a superset of our own reality. In other words, our what we perceive as reality is a subset of a bigger reality. You know what I mean?
So, I think that's a fair statement. Yeah.
Yeah. I like to say sometimes that UFOs are more real than us. You know, UFOs are real, and we ourselves are the imaginary ones.
Sure, and when people have near-death experiences, they also have that sense when they go into that other realm that where they are is more real than reality.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when we talk about evidence and stuff, I wanted to ask you this, Red Pill. Mm-hmm. You went to see the presentation of the Roswell slides.
Oh, my God. Are we going to that again?
Really?
My question for you is this.
I've evaded this. I've been on so many podcasts and I've evaded this conversation for so long.
But No, my question is this. What part did, was there any part of you that went into that thinking maybe there's something here, or did you just go, all right, let's watch this fall apart?
Oh, I knew from the get-go that it was nothing, you know, that it wasn't, they weren't going to show anything, you know, groundbreaking. I was really going like, you know, maybe it was my experience as after going as a teenager and watching episode one, you know, with Star Wars, you know, when your hope so high and to think that this is going to be the best experience of your life and then see Jar Jar Binks and see, oh my God, you know, so maybe I've become more cynical and bitter, you know, like Tim Binal.
So Jaime Maussan is the new George Lucas is what you're saying.
No, Jaime Maussan is Jar Jar Binks.
Wow.
So, anyway, and getting back to the question, no, from the things that I have already seen in the online discussion with regards to the so-called slides, my hopes and my expectations were already pretty low. You know, I was still trying to be fairly open-minded. And I also decided to go along with a cousin of mine who's also very interested in the UFOs. Well, not as interested as mine, you know. That's why he managed to have, you know, a successful career instead of me. So I went with him, you know, and I wanted to have him as a neutral bystander, you know, someone who wouldn't have been exposed to the things that I had already read online with regards to the things that the skeptics of the slides had already posted and Jaime Maussan's replies and whatever. And there were still a couple of things in that presentation that gave me pause. You know, there was this young guy whose name I really can't recall right now. You know, the guy who made a forensic analysis of the supposed alien body, who, you know, gave up a really what it seemed to me as a layman, as a very knowledgeable exposition of why this anomalous body couldn't possibly be, you know, the mummified corpse of a human child, you know? Mm-hmm. And I know by now that, you know, the weight of evidence is against that appreciation, but I still thought, well, you know, this person seems genuine enough, you know, I'm sure that he's not like a shill or, you know, or someone that Jaime Maussan hired to say these things, you know. So
right.
There is this, you know. And to be fair, after all that, all of what's happened with this particular case, I'm not sure that there's been a lot of people who have been going after the physical characteristics of the body exposed in those slides. You know, the most of the counter evidence has kept going along the ways of, you know, the implausibility of this scenario proposed by the big witness proponents and all that, you know, the idea that this couple, you know, would have been able to witness this, and that these slides were taken in some kind of military base, which is completely ridiculous, you know. I think right. By now it's really clear that it was taken inside the Mesa Verde Museum and whatever. So everybody has gone and focused on that. Even the Roswell slide research team, you know, composed of Kurt Collins and Paul Kimball and a few, Lance Moody and a few other people. But few people have really focused on these animals' characteristics. And that is the thing that at that moment, and I guess still gave me pause, and I said, well, you know, this is kind of weird. These things that these guys are apparently, these experts are apparently seeing in this body. But, you know, after all these months and after the supposed second episode of Big Witness that Jaime Maussan promised, you know, just after all the hoopla and all the things like exploded in his face, and like he promised to have a second event in one of the medical centers here in Mexico City. You know, there was going to be a free open event in which they were going to present more evidence for their case, but that event was canceled or postponed, and I'm not really sure what happened afterwards. You know, I kind of lost interest in that case, but I'm not sure what else to say. You know, I mean, the thing that, you know, confounds me the most is the fact that Jaime Maussan is still invited to presentations in the United States. You know, that no one has, you know, showed up in one of those conventions or conferences with a basket of tomatoes, you know, or you know, a basket of tars and feathers, you know, and like, you know, give him what he deserves.
Well, here's the thing that is interesting to me.
Okay.
In all the history of the UFO phenomena, we do not have even a potentially good photo of an alien.
Yes.
We have craft. We have lights. We have very good pictures in some cases of lights that don't seem to be fake, don't seem to be explainable. But we have zero when it comes to entities themselves, mm-hmm. which again leads me to the idea that these entities are not physical in the way that we're physical. Otherwise, you would think at some point somebody would have snapped a picture.
We also have very few convincing pictures of Bigfoot, you know what I mean? Aside from the Patterson-Gimli film, which was recorded in 1967.
Yeah.
What else? Well, what else do we have as evidence?
Yeah, I lose sleep at night over Bigfoot because I... No, seriously, though, I want Bigfoot so badly to be a flesh and blood creature, but if I'm completely honest with myself, there's something else going on there, and it really bothers me in a real way, because all the pieces are in place for it to be completely natural, and yet, yeah, somebody should have seen something, or somebody should have not seen something, but somebody should have hit something with their car or photographed it, or I don't care how many hunters come up to me and say, "I saw it, but it looked too human in the face. I just couldn't pull the trigger." Yeah.
Let's go back there. What you're saying. So, what exactly do you mean when thinking of Bigfoot as a flesh and blood creature?
I mean, some sort of biological anthropoid ape that has some sort of precedent in the fossil record, be it Gigantopithecus, be it some sort of in the case of shorter, more human-like entities, be it the case of Neanderthal man, something like that, some sort of basically just like a North American wood ape,
flesh and blood like us. That's what I think I was getting at.
Yes. Yeah. Flesh and blood. Completely terrestrial, just another living, breathing, goes to the bathroom in the woods creature.
Because you're assuming here, yeah, that we ourselves are just, you know, flesh and blood, you know, completely terrestrial things. That
You're killing me here. So
basically, like a bear.
Basically like a bear. Yeah.
And we think of bears and owls and all the things as just, you know. As our friend in Skeptical say, as biological robots who go in the woods and eat and take a dump, you know, and then they die and nothing else.
I mean, yeah, basically, and like part of me wants Bigfoot to completely fit into the materialistic scientific paradigm, and I'm not a materialistic scientific paradigm guy.
That's the conundrum, and that's the paradox, because, you know, at the same time that we want these mysteries to be, you know, accessible to our, you know, current materialistic paradigm, we ourselves are struggling to go beyond the materialistic paradigm because we see it as lacking, are wanting, are and not conforming with some of the phenomena we are experiencing in our daily lives, like, you know, precognition and synchronicities and near-death experiences. So it's kind of a messy thing we're into right now here in the 4GM world.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny. The more I've thought about the whole subject of Bigfoot, the more I want to incorporate other ideas that sort of make everybody happy. And I've talked about this before, how I think that, you know, perhaps Bigfoot is at once biological and the image of Bigfoot is utilized by other intelligences, much akin to the way that Mike Cleland says that owls can be co-opted to, you know, to more esoteric ends. And part of me also wonders, like, why we can't just possibly accept the idea of, you know, Neanderthal ghosts or Gigantopithecus ghosts, you know,
exactly.
Which is a nice, tidy way of wrapping up all those loose ends.
Like, there was this episode in the movie The Man Who Stared at Goats, you know, this guy who was used to being remote viewing, you know, states to Ewan McGregor, you know, who was supposed to be the character of John Ronson, you know, the guy who wrote the book. This guy says, the Loch Ness Monster is the ghost of a dinosaur. You know, and like saying, oh my God, you know, like trying to portray it as the most woo-woo, illogical thing to say. And at the same time, maybe that's the most plausible explanation for the Loch Ness Monster enigma, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm totally down with that. I mean, you talk to people who won't bat an eye at the idea that, you know, their cat Fluffy has returned from the grave to nuzzle them in the middle of the night, but think that all other forms of life on the planet come and go into the terrestrial sphere without leaving in some sort of residual impact. So I'm totally open to those ideas, which again sort of to me satisfies both of those criteria. The thing with Bigfoot is that so much of I'd be willing to completely write it away as something very very non-corporeal if so much of the anatomy didn't correspond in really specifically anthropological ways. Like, for example, some of the behavior, the pursed hooting of lips or pursed lips hooting really does seem to mimic a lot of great ape behavior. And to me, like, I don't know if something that was from, you know, the goblin universe would necessarily follow those parameters.
Well, it might once it interacted with us.
Exactly.
I mean, if you figure part of it's a projection from our consciousness, it has to conform to some degree to what we expect it to do.
Fair enough.
Yeah, we still perceive these entities as biped organisms, you know, portraying bilateral symmetry, you know. But if they come from a completely imaginal realm, they shouldn't conform to those, you know, natural laws.
True.
You know, so who knows?
there was something I posted recently that I had actually written a while ago where I said, what if we have completely lost touch with where we really should be? Like, we've kind of drifted off, and all these phenomena are really something they're trying to get us back, trying to get our attention to pull us back to where we should be.
You know what that reminds me of is the idea that I've heard posited a lot of times is that the abduction experience is more about getting us to foster a generation of shamans than it has anything to do with, you know, medical examination. You know, the idea that we've gone so far away from the internalized spiritual experience, having, you know, basically authority figures telling us how that we should run our lives in organized religion, that the other is actually directly involved with us now and trying to get us back on course to that, which I think is not at all an insane idea.
Yeah, the idea of the phenomenon to shake us out of our numbness, you know, to wake us up, you know, before we fall off the cliff.
If I'm remembering this right, I had a listener tell me that he'd always been interested in this type of stuff, and not a lot of stuff had happened to him, but his family, who was not interested at all, had this stuff, weird stuff happen to them all the time. And my response was, well, maybe they needed it.
Yeah, but see, that to me runs counter to a lot of the things that, you know, for example, Kiel experience, the way that you look at the phenomena and the phenomena looks back. And I think that when an interest is taken, an interest is noticed in these fields.
But I think you have to have a certain degree of interest. You really have to get in there before it starts looking back at you. You can't just be vaguely interested in it.
But what about, you know, the contactees, like, well, like we're talking about Kiel and the Mothman prophecies. What about Woody Derenberger, you know, meeting Indrid Cold, you know, in the middle of the highway? Where did his interest in this realm come from?
Well, that's what I'm saying. He didn't necessarily have one.
Okay.
Which is why it contacted him. Mm. It would contact them. I think this stuff, like the really anomalous experiences, happen to people who really have no interest in it. It's okay. A way of it waking people up.
Okay, okay.
To someone like me who sought it out, my experiences were very different. I didn't get abducted by aliens. Although at a certain point I realized my experiences were very similar in some structure to what people who were abducted or had these experiences are going through. They were in a completely different way. They were a more shamanistic sort of structure rather than a alien abduction sort of structure.
You see, but I have a fundamental problem with that, because if that was the case, then Richard Dawkins and Stephen Hawking should have had the most profound experiences, and they haven't.
I don't know. Maybe there's something that they, you know, deliberately reject, or they are deliberately avoid. You know, I remember with Richard Dawkins, I remember that he once tried out Michael Persinger's God Helmet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he only got a mild migraine out of it, you know? I remember mocking him unfairly on the Daily Grail and said that maybe this guy was, you know, it's the same as we say that some people are tone deaf, you know? He maybe was god deaf, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's totally legit. That's a good point.
It's entirely possible that some people are just not wired right to be able to change to that level of consciousness. Mm-hmm.
And we say this wired right to have this level of consciousness, but at the same time, we have to acknowledge the fact that people who have these experiences or have this sensitivity, they don't often have, you know, the best life experiences. You know, many people have had their lives utterly destroyed. You know,
by
mingling with these realms and these possibilities, you know, so maybe Dawkins' reaction of, you know, not even paying attention to it, maybe it's the right approach. I know.
Maybe that's entirely possible.
Well, I was just gonna say one of my favorite talking points, which I believe I've even brought up on here, is that's all perceived through this idea, this very Western idea, that there is no inherent value in suffering. You know, for all we know, the person who is led a very hard life is living a much richer life than those like Dawkins ever would. You know?
Yeah, it reminds me of some things that I have thought about when thinking about the abduction experience, and someone like David Jacobs saying that, well, there's obviously nothing positive coming out of the abduction experiences, because all this is people, you know, being tortured and taken against their will. You
know, there's obviously nothing positive, because I've thrown out all the positive data.
Yeah, right. And some people saying, well, you know, how could it be a spiritual experience if there is all this negative thing around? And my reaction to that is, well, Where is it written that spiritual experiences is all about, you know, singing Kumbaya and being all happy and comfortable, you know? You know, sometimes the best or the most important spiritual experiences are the ones that are, you know, wielded out or brought about by a lot of pain and suffering, as Joshua is suggesting.
And if you look at the shamanistic experience, that's exactly what it's not a easy, pleasant experience for someone to become a shaman. It's a very unpleasant and potentially dangerous, deadly type of a situation.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's all about nearing the brink of death, you know? And it's not that nearing the brink of death is a good thing, but the result of that, being able to commune with the spirit world, is a good thing, you know?
We don't learn much from good experiences.
Yeah.
We like them. I mean, we enjoy them. But the learning we get is when we have to figure our way out of bad experiences, yeah. or we have to deal with getting through that bad experience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's and the paranormal definitely seems to have a mix. I mean, it really does. It has. I had on last week a minister who had what he felt were demons attacking him. But in the end, it strengthened his faith. It released some hatred that he was holding inside. I mean, in the end, all the effects were positive.
Mm.
You know, and to him, it was a negative experience, but he came out so much better on the other side.
It's what Whitley Strieber writes when he talks about the teachings of Meister Eckhart, you know, that the demons who come and take you to hell, if you, you know, let go, you know, you release yourself, then the demons, you know, turn into angels and take you to heaven.
Yeah.
You know, Soraya, at the risk of derailing this conversation, I found that particular anecdote on that show very interesting. And one of the things that I found really interesting, and I don't know if you picked up on this, was the description of the initial demon that he experienced floating above his bed with the dragon. The dragon head, which to me sounds a lot like traditional Buddhist representations of demons. That mm-hmm. sort of that same sort of face. And I don't know if they're, I don't really know where I was going with this. I just wanted to point that out. I thought that was really interesting that, you know, that someone who is an ordained minister would have that sort of an experience.
That sort of imagery.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also it's interesting how in the Christian iconography, there's all these paintings of the temptations of some hermits and saints, you know, and they're all, you know, being shown tormented by demons, you know, and that is perceived as a sign of sanctity, you know. I mean, the idea is that, you know, people like me, you know, who have no problem going and sinning by their own accord, no demon will, you know, will bother trying to tempt me. You know, it's with people like Saint Therese and or Saint Thomas or whatever. That's where they will have, you know, like a legion of demons, you know, trying to tormenting him, tormenting them, and trying to lead them astray.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very true. I also found his story interesting, where he said, you know, this thing was talking to him while he was sleeping.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And he wondered, you know, does this happen all the time? Does this happen to other people and we just don't wake up and don't know that it's happening?
I yearn for a significant dream. I don't sleep well and I don't usually remember my dreams, but I have never had a dream that has in any way, to my mind, been perceived as significant.
Wow, really?
No, I really haven't. I've wanted it to be, but it's always like, it's always, you know, I had jam in my hair and I was walking down the street and someone said, "You're a backwards dog." And then I ate a sandwich. You know, it's always just nonsense.
It's a code.
I guess so. I guess it means that I should avoid jam.
I don't know, man. I mean, remember what Philip K. Dick used to say, that God left messages in the trash. So maybe, you know, God leaves messages in the most nonsensical dreams.
I don't know if I'd ever heard that quote. I love Philip K. Dick's work. I feel like there's a lot to dig in there that people in this particular community haven't really looked into with his life, and you know.
And that's him, one person, you know. That's an example of a life of suffering. You know, that's he had a really hard life.
Yeah.
And at some point, he's another person I'd like to do a show on.
You know, his widow, I was listening to a show about a year and a half ago, and they were taking callers, and one of them was apparently Philip K. Dick's widow. And they're like, oh, and apparently they didn't know who Philip K. Dick was. And I'm like screaming at the podcast. I'm like, keep this woman on the line. Because she was talking about all the weird stuff that happened in his life, and they're like, okay, uh-huh. And they just weren't really like, you know, yeah, it was not their finest hour. But she's out there and she's willing to talk. So if you can track her down, that'd be fantastic. Yeah.
That would be interesting. So Joshua, maybe you should try what, Mike Hughes there was doing, where he was taking all the melatonin and then his sort of sleep paralysis incident with the handprint.
My thing with here's the thing. Historically, my mother and I never really have slept well. If I wake up and like physically wake up to turn over and realize that I'm turning over like four times in a night, that's a great night of sleep for me. So when I take melatonin, I feel like it just basically brings me down to a regular night's sleep. So maybe I should dose up.
Do you do a lot of camping?
No, I don't.
Well, maybe you should try that out. What I'm getting at is maybe, you know, there is something about trying to sleep inside a modern room with all sorts of, you know, electrical and magnetical fields around you that might be the cause that is disturbing your sleep patterns. Whereas maybe trying to sleep in, you know, outside in the raw nature and wilderness might be a different experience.
You know, don't get me started on that, because I actually had a blog post a while back about how I think that part of the reason that paranormal activity has moved out of our lives as a collective society is because we've A, surrounded ourselves with electronics, somehow that might be interfering, and B, we've completely done away with the second sleep cycle.
Yeah,
we don't interact with the world in the wee hours of the morning, and when we do, we're constantly surrounded by this electronic grid, and that's why you see, you know, primitive peoples, not to use the term pejoratively, but just in terms of people who aren't plugged in, having more paranormal experiences, and they're in the outside and they're out in the wild, and they tend to adopt more flexible sleep patterns than we do.
Mm-hmm.
And the most of my experiences have occurred outside in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, without all the electromagnetics and stuff around. Not that I haven't had stuff happen all the time in different locations, but the majority, especially the major events, have always happened away from everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, also, to sort of build off that, I mean, whenever we travel, I traveled 30 miles to rehearsal tonight. In another, you know, 200 or even 150 years ago, that would have been like an overnight trip. and by merit of that, like the time that we would have spent out there in the wilderness, we would have spent more time in the outdoors traveling in that way. And so we would have had more opportunities to react with the other, but we're sequestering ourselves inside in this little net that we have, this little electronic net. And I can't help but wonder if that's the reason that people don't have a lot of these experiences. I mean, you know, Rosemary Ellen Guiley posited that actually the djinn, who she, not to put words in Rosemary's mouth, but I feel like she attributes a lot of paranormal activity to djinn. Right. She feels that actually these electronics tend to interfere with their ability to manifest. So I think that there's a kernel of truth there somehow.
It's entirely possible. There was a Japanese movie called, was it Pulse?
I have heard of it. I haven't seen it.
And they Americanized it. And it's one of the few movies they Americanized, and I think they actually made it more interesting. Because in this case, they had sort of the dead coming in through the electronics, through the electromagnetic fields. Like, this was opening up doorways to the dead. And I thought, well, that's really interesting.
That kind of speaks about John Keel's theory of the super spectrum.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the Japanese version was just ghosts. But the American version was ghosts getting access to this world through Wi-Fi. I think actually maybe the Japanese one was there too, but the American one made it a little bit more ultra-terrestrial and not just simply ghosts coming in.
Interesting.
So
you should check it out.
It was interesting. I mean, it did, because that's what it reminded me of. It reminded me of Keel and the super spectrum and such. Now, Red Pill Junkie, what about you? Do you dream a lot?
Oh yeah, yeah. And I have extremely vivid dreams, and I've also had a few lucid dreams. And I think that's actually one of the things that why I became such a fan of Carlos Castañeda, because in one of the books, when he starts to talk about, you know, what he calls dreaming, you know, the idea of waking up inside your dream, you know, and be totally conscious inside of it, you know, using very simple techniques like watching at your the palms of your hands, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember saying, "Well, I want to try that out," you know. And funny enough, one night it happened, and it was a groundbreaking experience for me to see. Wow! I mean, I'm inside this environment, inside this world that is allegedly completely inside my head, and I'm here, and I have complete almost complete volition, because the problem with my lucid dreams is are very, very brief. It's like, you know, the moment I realize I'm lucid, I'm quickly started to fade out. It's the same thing that my friend Greg Bishop said, that when he was trying meditation, and when he felt that he finally quieted his mind, and he finally entered into this type of headspace, and he was like, oh my God, and that's when...
Yeah,
boom.
Yeah.
He went out of it.
If I remember right, that was like Crowley's first thing to watch for is that your brain, the first thing your brain's going to do when you finally quiet your mind is go, "Ooh, look how good I'm doing."
Exactly. Like Terence McKenna, I think that the first time he met the machine elves, you know, I think that the first instruction that the machine elves give is, you know, try not to lose into wonder, you know, like, you know, don't freak out, you know, stay with us, you know, act normal.
Which dovetails with a lot of Eastern encouragement to lose the ego, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the ego keeps us here to some degree.
Well, I don't think that the ego isn't important, otherwise it wouldn't exist, but...
Right.
But, Oh, you mean just in terms of being an anchor to what we're... Yeah. No, I totally agree, yeah.
And I think we're here for a reason. I don't think it's like an accident. I don't think it's just something that happened for the hell of, you know, just for happening. I think we are here for a reason, and that ego lets us interact here.
Or maybe, here I'm speculating here, the ego is something akin to the appendix, something vestigial that served a function in the past, but that is, you know, something that we carried out and... as a weight, an unnecessary thing.
Well, that goes back into what I was saying, though, too. Like, maybe we're not where we're supposed to be, and we're trying to be lured back, you know, and maybe the ego is part of what's holding us here.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It sounds very Buddhist at that point.
Well, I was about to say, which Christian doctrine doesn't... I mean, I'm a Christian myself, but Christian doctrine does not prepare you for that very well at all.
Yeah.
Because the whole Buddhist concept is to give up, you know, the material world. It's to let go of the ego and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they might be onto something.
I think there's a lot of validity and a lot of truth in that. I mean,
and at the same time, I think they're still attached to a few things that are no longer make sense. For example, you know, a cousin of mine happened to become a Buddhist very recently, and the problem with that is that, you know, he became something of a zealot, you know. You know, he's always, you know, promoting and parading and yapping about, you know, Buddhism this, Buddhism that, Buddhism so great, you know. I remember once engaging with him, you know, in this very long and very, you know, heated discussion about how the idea that, you know, Buddhists don't eat meat because, you know, meat come from sentient beings, you know? So that is something that is against their ideas. And I told him, well, what about plants, you know? Oh, well, plants is okay. You know why? You know, I told him, what if plants also have consciousness? You know, no. The Buddhist teachings tell that the plants are below conscious level. Yeah. And I was, tell that to an Amazonian shaman who is always, you know, drinking ayahuasca and is communing, you know, with the spirit of the vine. Tell him that the vine has no consciousness.
I mean, heck with that. There have been scientific. I mean, I know you know this, RPJ. There have been scientific studies which have shown the organizational properties of plants, how they, you know, certain seeds from a certain pod will interact in certain ways and not step on each other's, you know, not intertwine, and certain plants will actually react when, you know, another of their species is attacked, or, you know, will react in certain ways. So I mean, it's not as cut and dry as they would like for it to seem, or as anyone would like for it to seem.
Yeah, exactly.
What was also interesting is when Rick Strassman did his latest book, he went away from the Buddhist idea and was looking at the Old Testament concepts when he was looking at DMT, because he's like, well, you know, we have these altered states of consciousness and they don't match up with the Buddhist ideas of annihilation, essentially. These are way more dynamic. There's so much more going on. This is contact with something else, and he found the closest resemblance there in the Old Testament, not in the Buddhist culture.
Well, you know, all of it's fascinating to me because, I mean, I think it was actually during a conversation that Joe Rogan was having with Graham Hancock, and Graham was saying that he's not really for morality reasons, I don't believe, but he's just sort of a pescatarian, or like a shellfishitarian, whatever that might be. And Joe Rogan said, well, he says, like, you know, he says, my attitude is everything on Earth lives because something else dies, and it's just a natural cycle. And to me, I have to agree with that, because, I mean, if you look at, I mean, if there is something to this idea of reincarnation, I don't want to say it devalues life, but it puts everything in a lot bigger perspective and a lot more of a balance, you know, in terms of things having to die so other things might live. Because something has to be hurt for you to live. That's just the nature of being incarnate on this planet.
Every human being in this planet has a body that is composed of carbon that was the result of an exploding star millions of years ago. So what if stars are also conscious beings, you know?
Yes.
You know, and I think that's something that even Dean Radin has speculated about.
Sun consciousness. Yeah, I've heard that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think any organized system could potentially have consciousness.
Yeah, which brings us back to the idea of plasma entities, you know, which will be conscious as an intelligent, because we think of it, you know, plasma is electrons that are organized in a matrix that is heated up gas, and maybe those electrons are organized in a fleeting way, in a fleeting moment maybe, but in the same way as the neurons in our brain, you know, are organized and structured and firing up and communicating with each other, you know, that maybe there is a way in which plasma could contain consciousness and intelligence if it's organized and structured enough.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then what?
Well, you know, it's the first law of hermeneutics, as above, so below. And I wouldn't doubt it if we're all atoms in a cosmic brain. Or neurons in a cosmic brain, as it were.
Exactly.
Or we're all atoms in the cells in the Earth's brain, which is then, you know, part of the solar system's brain, which is part, and it just keeps going out.
Russian dolls.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Tortures all the way down.
Oh, all right. So I think that's a good place to stop for tonight. I'm going to be doing some more midweek podcasts with both of you.
Perfect.
Let's start with RPJ. Where can people find you online?
Well, you know, my main hub in the web is, of course, the Daily Grail, www.dailygrail.com. I also occasionally write for Mysterious Universe, not so regularly anymore, but, you know, I'll do my best to catch up. And, you know, from I'm also the semi-regular guest in the Grimerica show. You know, this is the podcast that was started by my Canadian friends, Darren and Graham. And also, you know, get together with them from time to time. I'm also in the process of creating my own personal website, you know. I'm leaving it at that for the moment because, you know, I haven't given myself the time to build it and to make something, you know, worth watching.
Okay. All right. And Josh?
You can find me on online at joshuacutchin.com, JOSHUACUTCHIN. I try to put blog posts up there as often as I can. But a lot of my time right now is focusing on a follow-up to my first book, which is A Trojan Feast, which is available from Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
All right. Any last words, guys?
Always a pleasure.
Keep watching the skies.
All right. We're going to take you out with some... I think we're going to take you out with some Mechanism. This is Mouth of God from the brand new Mechanism EP. And we'll see you next week with Steve Stockton as he comes to tell us about his paranormal experiences.
legend inside us. The spirit reminds us from the mouth.